Good evening. I'm Cubby Selby. I'm an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here. I love participating in AA, and I love speaking at meetings. I get to relive the miracle of my life. And I also forget how to think about me for a while. And it always makes me feel marvelous. So if I can just forget about that for a second. I'm the kind of alcoholic that never drank in high school and I never drank in college. I never went to high school and I never went to college. But I learned how to drink. I can't say successfully. I lost my first job due to drinking at the age of 15. And of course it got progressively worse, as we all know, and as our disease guarantees. But I love alcohol. I really love alcohol. It is a gift of the gods. <I'm> telling you. Obviously, alcohol must have done a whole lot for me to be willing to let it do so much to me. And it eventually destroyed everything I held dear in life. But for a while, it was the greatest blessing in my life. For me, it's not a coincidence that the word spirit means God and it means booze. If you're anything like me, drinking was a spiritual experience. I've come to believe that the most horrendous thing a human being can experience is to feel separated from themselves. And that's how I felt all my life, but I never knew that. I wasn't aware of what that thing was that was torturing me. And I can't be aware of anything until I'm recovering from it. I don't know I'm an alcoholic until I'm sober. I don't know that. I don't know I'm powerless over. I have no idea how alcoholism operates in my life until I get sober and view my experience with alcohol through the perception of Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, I have no idea what's going on. I'm just talking about me. I only know things in retrospect. Sometimes many, many years later, 30, 40 years later, I understood what happened all that time ago. But feeling separated from you didn't bother me because I thought you were the most loathsome, ignorant, despicable bunch of yahoos that I've ever seen in my life. So that didn't bother me because who wanted to be a people? And feeling separated from the big weasel in the sky, that certainly didn't bother me. But one thing I can't tolerate is to feel separated from me. That is absolutely unbearable. And I never knew this is what I was feeling. And I never understood any of the reasons why. It wasn't until I got sober that I understood that all my life I was overwhelmed with a sense of guilt, a sense of shame, an overwhelming sense of inadequacy, and underneath everything was an all-consuming fear, and I had to deny that it existed. I couldn't live in my own skin, no less this world that absolutely terrified me. And I knew there was something so morally defective about me, I didn't have the right to breathe this foul air. And I went through life like a scream, looking for a mouth. I just hit everything under this all-consuming rage. But when I took a drink, I take a drink, man, and the angels sing. It's a wonderful, wondrous thing, because all of a sudden, that little mechanism that's tortured, tormented all the time, that sees a pussycat looking through a garbage, crying, I can't stand it anymore, I want to kill myself, life is crazy. But this is real. This isn't drama. This is the reality of my life. But I take a drink and, who cares? Why do I care? I'm not afraid, I'm not inadequate. Matter of fact, I'm smugly superior. But the big thing about drinking was I became a holy man. I became one whole, solid, unified being. And I had a sense of peace that I never knew existed. Oh, what a wondrous and glorious thing. And then some clown will tell me, hey, man, you shouldn't drink. Drop dead, you fool. I will admit that my drinking may be a problem for you. But it's the answer for me. See, I drink, I black out, and I tend to get extraordinarily homicidal. So it is true that if I drink, I might kill you. But that's the chance I have to take. Believe me, I'm willing to take that chance, man. I mean, one more or less, who cares? Another Yahoo off the earth, no big deal. But I'm willing to do anything. I'm willing to take any chance to experience that sense of unity and peace. So I can't see where alcohol is a problem. Because it is the glorious, glorious answer. And I have to protect my right to drink. Because I've always known I can't. So I have to protect my right to drink in every way I can. Which means I have to develop a belief system of lies. I taught myself what is true is false and what is false is true. The basic lie being that alcohol is the answer, not the problem. Excuse me. Now, I left home at 15. I went to sea. I was a merchant seaman. And by the time I was 18, I was taken off a ship in Germany, and they said I couldn't live more than 2 months. I had TB, and both lungs were totally shot, and there was just nothing functioning inside. And yet, 2 weeks before this particular day, while going through the canal in Antwerp, I jumped off the ship and I ran to a wine shop and I ran back with 4 or 5 bottles of wine. And I look back at that day now, and it seems to me that that indicated I had an abnormal relationship with alcohol. Because I doubt if a non-alcoholic would run, say, a quarter of a mile or less to get 4 or 5 bottles of wine when they didn't have any lungs. But you see, we're motivated people. Yeah. I don't let a thing like that interfere with my drinking. And I can't see. I cannot see the truth. I must believe that belief system of lies, because even though I'm dying, I have to protect my right to drink. And I can't see when my life is unmanageable. Yet by the time I was 22 years old, I had spent more than 3 years in bed. I had 10 ribs cut out. I had one lung collapse, a piece of the other lung cut out. And they used an experimental drug to keep me alive. And it impaired my vision and my hearing. My inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk properly. And I'd stagger, and I'd fall down in the dark. All my muscles were petrified from this drug. And my brain was fried. It just destroyed everything. And then things started to get bad. And that's a guarantee we have as drunks. No matter how bad things are, man, drinking will make them worse. That's a flat-out guarantee. But again, I can't see when I'm powerless over alcohol. I can't afford to accept that simple fact. Now, as I said, I had to defend my right to drink, and one of the things I did to do that was use heroin. And I developed a heroin sobriety maintenance program for myself. And it proved conclusively to me I'm not an alcoholic. You can't be alcoholic when you're shooting $100 a day worth of stuff and only getting drunk once or twice a month or whenever necessary. So in a sense, it worked. But this program got a little habitual and a little expensive. But it lasted for 6 years, and it did its duty. But anyway, the second step implies that we're nuts. And what I did is I left New York and I moved to Hollywood to get away from drugs. Because I have that keen kind of thinking. But I was so sincere, my heart was so sincere that it worked. I got busted. I got busted, they strapped me down in solitary and I kicked my habit. Now this is what you call a no-frills approach to doing a thing like this, man, I'll tell you. But it didn't cost me 20 grand either. But I did have a 2-year follow-up. The judge said, keep coming back. Ooh, God. You hurt me to the quick, Your Honor. You know, I was in that cell a week, and they asked me if I wanted to come out, and I said no. I can't tell you how safe I felt in that cell. You know, they're small and they're cozy. And, of course, it was very private, extraordinarily private. But the thing that I felt safe from was me. I knew I couldn't do anything to me locked in that cell. And by this time in my life, I could no longer deny that somehow I was doing me in. Now, I did not associate any of my problems with drinking. However, I knew I was doing something that was doing me in, and I was just tired of running those streets. I can't walk the streets, no less run those streets. And I was tired of it. So I stayed in that cell a month, and then they kicked me out, put me with population for a month. And then somebody came up, they bailed me out, put me in a hospital for a month. And then suddenly I was back out on the streets. The same world I've never understood, the same world has intimidated me. Only this time I hadn't had a drink for 90 days. And I could no longer really believe in the belligerence and hostility that I always generated to hide my fear from you and from me. And I was so terrified I couldn't cross a street. The only thing that got me through an intersection was going for a drink. The only motivation that could get me to cross the street. That went on for 15 months, and a woman I was living with brought home another woman with three kids because they had no place to live, and they moved in. The guy visited this woman, and one Friday night he came and he visited with me. Now, as I say, I'm a blackout drinker, so I don't remember more than perhaps a total of 30 seconds from the entire evening. But I remember him coming into the room and sitting down. And the next thing I remember is him getting up, walking over to me and dropping a book in my lap and saying, "I'm tired, you read to me." So I guess he had been reading to me, I don't know. I assume that, but I have no direct memory of it. And I remember putting this book on the table, opening it up, and that's the last thing I remember from the night. But it turned out that I was reading from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And evidently I read enough to identify with the problem and to recognize the answer. He took me to a meeting the next night, and I've been sober ever since. And that was the 29th of March, 1969. And a couple of things happened in the next 12 hours or so that forced me to believe that miracles are possible without my consent. And I'm very grateful to know that, because I will never consent to the miracle in my life. Never. I won't do it. Nobody forces anything on me. Not even happiness. But I've also come to believe that unless I cooperate with that miracle, I will not experience it for the rest of my life. Now, he took me to a meeting, and I hated that meeting. I just raged at everything I heard and saw. And there was only one thing I knew at that meeting, that I am not an alcoholic. That was the one thing I knew absolutely. Yet, I was rendered sober at that meeting. I was given the gift of sobriety. The first step took me, and I've been unable to drink since that meeting. So the first step took me. He took me home, and I heard myself say, "Can I go to another meeting?" I had no intention of saying that. And I've come to realize that I did not say that. What I mean by I did not say that, the cubby that I was aware of at the time did not say that. But I've come to realize and be aware of a being, a spirit, whatever you choose to call it, that I was unaware of then. There was so much more to me than I was aware of at that first meeting. That's what spoke the words through me. And when I spoke those words, I took the second step. He took me home. I asked, "Can I go to another meeting?" And the next morning, I started my day in the usual manner. I started a fight with this woman I was living with in order to justify storming out of the house and getting drunk. As I've said, I've always known I can't drink, so I have to justify drinking. So I have to drink at something. Mostly I drank at people, but I would drink at the weather, I would drink at earthworms, I would drink at traffic lights. As long as I could justify within myself doing what I knew absolutely I cannot do. So I stormed out of the house. And I was standing on the corner waiting to cross the street. And that same vicious voice that I've heard screaming in my head all my life was there. Only this time, on the basis of one meeting, two words got changed. And it said, "I'll show her." "I won't drink. I'll stay sober." Boy, and if you think you can punish people by drinking, boy, you can do a much better job when you're sober. Am I a killer? Especially with that sullen silence. Oh, man, you know, you don't have to make amends for that. I didn't say anything. It's a funny thing. No, you believe it at the time. At least I do. At the time, I believe it. Or I try to. Anyway. So my body turned around and went back to the house. That morning, the second step took me. I was restored to sanity. Now, most of my sobriety, I've been mad as a hatter. My sobriety has been far more painful than my drinking. Oh, for one thing, I've been there all the time. I've been aware of it. I don't get to pass out. I don't get to forget. You know, it's just right in front of me. Anyway, what I mean by being restored to sanity is I could no longer believe the lies necessary to believe in order to justify taking the first drink. I could no longer believe that drinking would improve the quality of my life in any way. I have been absolutely sane since that moment. Now, I don't restrict the sanity available through the second step to just that. But obviously, without that foundation, nothing else, no other form of sanity is possible for me. So, I'm restored to sanity. I can't drink, so I don't drink. I don't fight it. I don't even recall making a decision. I just didn't drink. And at the end of 30 days, I was stark raving sober. Now, as we all know, there is only one thing worse than drinking, and that's not drinking. Yeah. And if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be here. Not drinking is the problem. Like the book says, the bottle's only a symbol. We have a living problem. I mean, once you stop drinking, then you find out what you're really about, right? The things that we do sober. Anyway, fun and games, right? The point is that when you take away the most important thing in someone's life, you must replace it with something of value. Nature cannot and will not accept a vacuum. When you take alcohol out of my life, I'm left with that dark, black, cancerous sense of separation that I started with. So if you don't replace alcohol with something of value, I must drink. I have absolutely no choice in the matter. I must drink because I am powerless over alcohol. And I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is something of value that fills that hole and fulfills every need I shall ever have for the rest of my life. Now, I've come to believe that life is an extraordinarily simple process. I believe it is so simple and so obvious that I can't see it, you know? There is nothing more difficult for me to see than the simple and obvious. But as far as, say, now, as I've told you, I didn't go to school very long. I did finish the ninth grade. I mean, I'm not totally unschooled. But the only thing that I know about anything is what I've learned in and through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So looking at the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I cannot separate from life. Seems to me that life is extraordinarily simple. It's a series of decisions, actions, and results. Results always inevitable, at times predictable, but always inevitable. And sooner or later, I must make a series of decisions followed by the appropriate action. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. Now, evidently I was, but I was unaware of it. Again, that inner self is taking care of business, and I'm walking around in a daze. So that inner self, after 30 days, decided we must stay sober. And somehow it got me to take the appropriate action, which was to go to an AA meeting and ask for help, which I did. And the help was instantly and automatically there. And again, the reason for that is simple and obvious. Because the answer is in the asking. You cannot have a problem without already having the answer. It is a spiritual impossibility to have a problem without already having the answer. However, I still have this belief system of lies that I developed and nurtured to protect my right to drink. So I am unaware of already having what it is I'm so desperately looking for. But when I go up to you and say, help me, tell me what to do, not, excuse me, would you like to sit down and discuss the big book with me? No, asshole, I don't, you know. But I'll tell you what to do, you know. What you do is you get up in the morning before you urinate. You go to the bathroom. You brush your teeth. You don't drink. And you go to a meeting. Oh, when I come up to you and say, tell me what to do, I've given up. I've surrendered. And instantly the answer's available to me from within me. And I will never find the answer anywhere else. As a matter of fact, nothing exists outside of Cubby for Cubby other than an opportunity for me to give everything away. That's the only thing that exists outside of me. So when I say, help me, I have the answer. It's right there. Because surrendering like that makes it possible for the answer to transcend that belief system of lies. And then when you share with me what you did at that point in your recovery, you make it possible for me to recognize the answer in whatever way I need to stay sober for the next 24 hours. So after 30 days, I asked for help and I was given a gift of recovery. Now I'm face to face with the third step, and that word is there. And the kindest thing I ever said about God is that it's dog spelled backwards. After my last operation, I was in a coma for 4 days. And at some point in that period, I opened my eyes as a chaplain walked in the room. And I stayed conscious long enough, maybe 2 seconds, just long enough to shake my head no and watch him leave. Because I knew he was there to give me the hocus pocus and I didn't have anything to do with it. I was determined that if I died, I was going to die giving God the finger. And if there was such a thing called God, I couldn't wait to die so I could meet it, spit in its face, and tell it what I thought of it. I've been told that's an attitude. And AA is the only place I know where you can bring an attitude like mine and have it turned into a love affair, not by going to church, not by taking religious instructions or studying theology or dogma or metaphysics or psychology, but by not taking one drink one day at a time and hanging out with a bunch of sober drunks. And that's exactly what happened to me. And also, you see, at this point that I'm just referring to, I was still a teenager. So it's not that years of drinking warped my attitude. It's just that I had this rotten attitude that I took to drinking. And alcohol made it possible for me to survive in this world with an attitude like that. And it's a very painful attitude. So now I'm face to face with this third step. And this inner being says, got to make this decision. And I go around asking people, how do you take the third step? And again, it's not until years later that I realized that as soon as I asked that question, it meant I had already taken the step. But I can't see these things at the time. Matter of fact, I can't really see anything at the moment. It's only in retrospect when I can examine the experience, the result, through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I have any understanding of what has already happened. So I couldn't see that it meant I had, that asking the question meant I had taken the step. The step simply asks me to make a decision. And as the book says, it must be followed by a program of vigorous action. So then it seemed like everyone is saying you have to pray. I said, what the hell? I don't know what to do about this. Pray? So I copied the third step prayer and the St. Francis prayer, and I tacked them on the wall. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd read them, go about my business at night, I'd read them and go to sleep. Then everyone says you have to kneel, you have to kneel in prayer. God, wow, seems so childish. But and this is another great thing. I desperately wanted to stay sober, and I didn't know it.
Please turn it over.
Wow, seems so childish. But and this is another great thing. I desperately wanted to stay sober, and I didn't know it. I still didn't know it. So I tried to kneel and pray 20 and 30 times a day. I would try and do it. I couldn't do it. My knees would not bend. Then when I was sober 4 months, I took my fifth step. When I finished, my sponsor showed me the pages in the book to read that tell you exactly what to do for 6 and 7. I went home and did as the book suggests. And when I had taken the sixth step, I was made aware of it. Now, I've come to believe that the essence of the sixth step is simply that when there's no longer a payoff in the defect, I am willing to let it go. It seems to me that all my life I had the insane idea that I could avoid pain by pursuing pleasure. I obviously believed there was a difference between pleasure and pain. And it is the one and the same thing. The only difference is perception. I can't go into a store and spend the heads of a nickel. Yeah. I have to give them the entire coin. And I cannot separate pleasure from pain. It's absolutely impossible. I don't believe anybody can deliberately and consciously hurt themselves. I think what the problem is, we have a misconception of what will make us feel good. And there may have been a time in our lives when certain behavior did make us feel good. Maybe it did protect me from something. Just as alcohol at one point in my life was absolutely necessary. Because I can't live with this disease of alcoholism unless I'm either drinking or I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, I'm doomed. Because I can't drink and I can't not drink. But there's this point where alcohol actually makes it possible for me to survive in this world. In other words, I don't hold on to the pain of a defect. I don't hold on to the pain of resentment. I'm always willing to let the pain of resentment go. But what I hold on to is the pleasure of judgment. I mean, who's power? What a gasser to sit home alone. Powerless? Oh, no. Not with my imagination and when I can get you and rake you over the coals. You know, we know. You know what I'm talking about. And then 3 or 4 days later, I wake up 3 o'clock in the morning like this in a cold sweat. And then I get on my knees and hocus pocus God. Oh, God, I can't stand this bed. Oh, hocus pocus God. Don't bother me, schmuck. Now, if I am willing to give up the pleasure of judging you, if I never judge you, I don't have to hocus pocus God with the pain of resentment, do I? But who wants to give up pleasure, right? You know, you stay sober long enough, you get a lot of calls from guys. Oh, man, this chick died. Oh, I can't stand this pain. Well, why don't you just be celibate for a while? You never get another phone call. You know, getting too many phone calls? I'll tell you how to thin the ranks like that. I'm serious. Refer them to the steps. Yeah. So anyway, if I'm willing to give up pleasure, then I don't get involved in the pain. And everybody gets here battling with the God of our fathers, that God of punishment, that anthropomorphic creation of the ego that drives us nuts. So we want to get rid of that God, right? But who wants to get rid of the God of rewards? And as long as I hold on to that belief in a God of rewards, I will get zapped. No good deed goes unpunished. I will get raked over the coals with that God of punishment. That is a flat-out guarantee. You just can't avoid it. And what do? We get in here with that old belief system, change the vocabulary, change a word here and there, the higher power. And it's that same old anthropomorphic creation of the ego. We just gave it a different language. And then we can't figure out why we're dying all the time, And believe me, when they say this is a slow process, it is. Because how much can you get rid of at any given moment without the beingness being destroyed? For instance, to use a corny analogy, if you're a diver and you're down 600 feet in the ocean and you want to get to the surface, it takes you a long time, baby. You better take it nice and easy, or what do? You get the bends, you die, all kinds of things happen. So it takes time to get rid of the old ideas, because you can't just get rid of the entire structure of your life instantly. All these lies are what are holding us together, So we have to just peel them away slowly so that it can be replaced with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, when I'd taken the sixth step, as I made aware of it, without thinking, I was on my knees taking the seventh step. And that day I was given the gift of prayer. I've come to believe the gift of prayer is the most precious thing that we're given by whatever this power is that created us. With the gift of prayer, it starts to take on a living reality. A living reality. I've come to believe from my experience as the prayer. And of course, that's part of the goal, part of the result, part of the evolutionary process, is to stop praying and be the prayer. I know from my experience as the prayer that there's nothing to get, there is only everything to give. And it's only in the process of giving it away that I become aware of having it in the first place. And I believe AA is the perfect place for me to give everything away. I also know from my experience as the prayer that I don't pray to God. There is nothing to pray to, but I pray from God. And when we say that life is an inside job, that's not a metaphor. It is an absolute simple statement of truth. Life is an inside job. And I believe the prayer that mends the broken hearts and heals the sick minds that we all bring to Alcoholics Anonymous is the song of love we sing to this thing we call God. And it sings a song of love to us. I believe that song is heard in every heart throughout the world and throughout the entire universe. And with steps 10 and 11, we can not only sit and hear that song, but experience the simple truth that in all of the universe there's only one song, and we are that song. Each and every note just as important and vital as the other. No one note is more important than any other note. Obviously, if one note is missing, the song is changed, and we are that song. So with the seventh step, I was given a gift of prayer. With the ninth step, I was given a gift of love. When I was 6 months sober, I became aware of the fact that I had fallen in love with this thing called God. Now, I've been given up for dead, three or four times in a hospital, many times in the streets. And the only thing that kept me alive was what I thought was my hatred for God. And 6 months with you, it turned into a love affair. Yeah, and I didn't understand it, but later on I read AA comes of age. In the back of the book, they quote an old Spanish philosopher. A very simple line that explains it. It says, those who deny God deny him because of their despair at not finding him. I thought I was unworthy of having this thing. I wanted this more than anything in the world. I wanted it more than life. And I was convinced I couldn't have it. In 6 months with you, I found out I not only have it, but it happens to be the only thing I can never be without. Another one of those beautiful paradoxes of life. The one thing I can never be without is the one thing I thought I could never have. An old axiom says, the holiest ground in the world is where an ancient hatred has been turned into a current love. So because of what has happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, wherever I am standing on the holiest ground in the world. And I believe it's impossible to take the first 9 steps without standing on the holiest ground in the world. I believe it's a predictable and inevitable result of the decisions and actions preceding it. Now, it may take you as long as it took me to become aware of that simple fact, but I believe it must and will happen. With the 12th step, I have this great gift, my own personal relationship with this living power that created me. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, it's the only thing we're working towards, the only thing, a spiritual awakening. And you notice, it doesn't say we have a spiritual awakening as a reward, but as a result. It's just an inevitable and predictable result of the decisions and the actions preceding it. In the back of our book, in the second appendix, they take a page and a half to discuss spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. And what it does is demystifies the terminology. This is not some esoteric or arcane technique I was master for 20 years to have the experience. This is not some involved or convoluted theological and dogmatic concept. This is a very, very simple experiential program. Among other things, the word spirit simply means essence. The Latin root is spiritus, and it means breath. We're simply dealing with the essence of life, the breath of life. And the book tells us exactly where we find it, deep within ourselves. The only place we find the great reality is deep within ourselves. And this is a flat-out guarantee. You take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you must and will have a spiritual awakening. You cannot prevent it, and you can deny it, but you cannot prevent it. It must and will happen. So at the 12th step, I have my own personal relationship with whatever this power is that created me. Now, this is not somebody else's concept of God. And this is not some institution's concept of God. And it is not my concept of God. But this is simply a power of infinite and unconditional love that has revealed itself to me from within me as a direct result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And wherever I am, all of this power is. I can never have less than everything there is. But the nature of obsession is to want more than everything there is. So obviously an obsession can never be satisfied. Yeah, it just can't. And I still have this belief system of lies that tries to convince me that I don't have what it is I'm looking for. I believe it's impossible. For me, know it's impossible to conceive of praying for something I do not already have. And if you think about it for 3 seconds, you'll see how obvious it is. How can you conceive of praying for anything if you don't already have it? You couldn't conceive of it. I mean, it's obvious when you realize it, but it wasn't obvious to me all those years. So for me, what prayer is, what AA is a process of uncovering the lies of that belief system, discarding the lies of that belief system, and discovering the truth, however it manifests itself in my life at any particular moment. I just uncover, discover. And that's as simple as it is. Now, I obviously thought that you have a spiritual awakening and you just never say another word in anger, and you don't chase people up on the sidewalk in your car. You don't do those things anymore. I was mistaken. As I said, my sobriety is far worse than the drinking. And I battled my demons, and I just didn't know what I was doing for many years. And finally, my wife had to leave. After being together for 15 years, her sobriety and her life were threatened just by my madness and depressions. I'd stay locked up for days. And anyway, it was a horrendous experience for me and for her and the children. And she loved me unconditionally at the moment she left, as I loved her. But I knew that nobody could really survive living with me. So she left, and our son, who was 12, elected to stay with me. And we were in Massachusetts at the time. We got back to L.A. Someone said we could stay with him until I got on welfare, and I did. I got on welfare and got us a little two-room apartment, and Bill and I moved in. When we moved in, we had two suitcases each. I had an old piece of foam rubber somebody gave me to sleep on, and somebody gave him an old army cot to sleep on. That's all we had. I was 14 years sober. I was a single parent on welfare, and I still don't know how I survived those days. But then I experienced the fellowship in a way I never had before, because you literally fed us, you clothed us, pots, pans, towels, everything came from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that Christmas, I didn't know what the hell I was going to do for Bill. It seemed so unfair that he wouldn't have a Christmas because of my disease. Anyway, we ended up going down to the Skid Row and serving food to the people down there. It was one of the greatest days of my life. He was so happy being down there serving the food to the people and making sure the kids got extra milk and pie. I mean, he lit up all of Skid Row. And I was so overwhelmed with gratitude and love and joy to be a part of such a wonderful, wonderful human being and part of a process that's incomprehensible but obviously exquisitely beautiful. And we did that each Christmas. We were together. And I'd get him up in the morning. I'd feed him breakfast. We'd pray. We'd meditate. And I'd sit there and cry. I don't know how I survived those years. But somehow I didn't drink. I went to meetings and I helped drunks. To this day, I don't know how. And then one day my wife called and said she was in love with someone else. And by that time I had cried so much I was totally empty inside. As I said, I accepted responsibility for her need to leave, so I wasn't filled with the resentments that I've always had in the past with broken relationships. Then a miraculous thing happened. I was praying for her one morning, and this wondrous prayer came out of me. And I heard myself thanking God that she had somebody to love, that she had someone to share her life with, to share her body with, to share her program with, and to share her God with. Now, I know I'm not capable of sitting down and formulating such a prayer, but I don't have to. I simply have to make the decision to be loving and then take the necessary action. In this case, it was to pray. And this is what I believe happened. I certainly can't prove this, but with all of my being, this is what I believe. I believe your love for me wrote that prayer. I don't know when. It may have been at my first meeting. It may have been 10 years later, I don't know. Or it may have been written one day at a time through all the years. But you wrote that prayer, and you loved me so much. You put that prayer in my heart so that when my heart broke, it broke open with the pain of her leaving, and I had the honor and privilege of speaking those words and then experiencing the results of that. Alcoholics Anonymous. What a greatest spiritual experiment in all the known history of the human race, without exception. See, when I got here like everybody else, insulated and isolated in the eye of alcoholism. And I get here, and the very first word of the program is we. We admitted. We not only admit powerlessness, we admit each other into these rooms and into our hearts. And we continue to practice the principles, we experience the one. So instantly, my first meeting, the I of my disease starts to become a part of the we of our recovery, and in time we experience the one. the oneness of all life. When I got here, you saw beyond the crazed, drunken beast I believed I was. Beyond that, you saw a sober being. Within that sober being, you saw light, and you saw love. And you held that image of me in your mind as you nurtured me, you loved me, and most importantly of all, you allowed me to make every mistake I must make in order to learn what I need to learn to stay sober for the next 24 hours. And more as I continue to come back to you, I am becoming that image that you have of me, as you are becoming the image that I have of you. And together we are becoming the vision that God has of us. Thank you very much.
We're going to thank Cubby for really having a real good feeling, but I don't know where I'm at. I've asked Beverly to read a vision for you.
My name is Beverly, alcoholic. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
I want to thank Michael for reading Chapter 3, Les for reading Chapter 5, Sterling for the 12 Traditions. I want to thank our speaker again for sharing with us. Thank you for coming tonight. You're all cordially invited back next week when our speaker will be led. Our meeting will be led by another sober alcoholic, John from Los Angeles. Thanks for being patient with me. This sucks. What am I supposed to do? Good night. Oh, and after a moment's silence of meditation for the alcoholic who still suffers, Linda, would you lead us in a prayer of your choice?
This is recorded June the 25th, 1996, at Arbor Road Speakers Meeting.
This is a Caskey recording.
For copies of this and other tapes, write P.O. Box 15818, Long Beach, California, 90815.